Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it.
We have got a cast iron assurance and a guarantee from the British government.
The particular problems around the Irish border are being used politically to try to frustrate Brexit.
Northern Ireland must leave the European Union on the same terms as the rest of the United Kingdom.
Northern Ireland would form part of our customs territory.
Hello and welcome to Brexit Republic, RTE's podcast on Brexit. I'm Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor in the Romanian city of Sibiu.
And I'm Sean Whelan, RTE's economics correspondent, standing in for Colm O'Mungon. Each week, Brexit Republic assesses all the latest Brexit developments in Brussels, London and Dublin.
As Europe turns its attention to the European Parliament elections, I'll be casting a gimlet eye over how Brexit might overshadow those elections, what the results will mean for Europe's top jobs, and what that might mean in turn for Brexit.
And with continuing deadlock in those talks between Labour and the Tories over how the withdrawal agreement might get over the line, we'll get the view from RTE's London correspondent Fiona Mitchell.
Yes, indeed. All the talk now is on Theresa May's future, a Tory leadership race, and what all that might mean for a no-deal situation in the autumn, a general election, or indeed a second referendum.
We'll also hear from a European policy analyst on how no pathways out of the Brexit crisis seem to offer a happy ending. But first, Tony, what has you in Sibiu in Romania? And did Brexit spoil the party down there?
Well, Sean, I'm in Sibiu because back when Brexit happened, when the referendum happened, the EU had this bright idea of having an informal summit immediately afterwards just to show the world that the EU was not constantly preoccupied by Brexit, that they had a vision for the future that they could project to citizens. And that was going to happen here in Sibiu because Romania has the rotating presidency of the EU. Now, obviously, Brexit has spoiled the party a bit because, as we know, Britain is still in the EU and it's all very messy. So they've had to somewhat calibrate their message from Sibiu, and also the fact that the European Parliament elections are happening so soon. Some of the whole question of the policy around the next five-year agenda for the European Commission for the new European cycle is so sensitive that they didn't want to necessarily spell out in graphic detail what the strategic agenda would be, given that it will have to deal with things like Russia, like migration, the rule of law, all those things which are fairly toxic issues in the European Parliament elections, particularly in countries like Italy and, of course, Poland and Hungary. So what we had in Sibiu was a kind of a scaled back declaration, what's called a Sibiu declaration. It's a 10-point, I suppose, vista of Europe in the future post-Brexit. A lot of talk about unity, solidarity, the rule of law, democracy, defending Europe's place in the world. And then we had the first nibbling, if you like, at both the strategic agenda, which of course is the five-year plan for the new incoming Commission and Parliament, and the question of who is going to get the top jobs in Europe. There was a bit of chatter over that, but by and large, this was described as a throat-clearing exercise in Sibiu before the European Parliament elections take place, and before the strategic agenda of the next 5 years. You know, what will the new commission be really tackling and how will they tackle it? What will the key issues be? All of that will be fleshed out in more detail in the June European Council. So a very lovely and ornate place to come for EU leaders. A lot of them just came and went in the one day. We, of course, have stayed here for a couple of days just to provide the coverage. Again, not any real substance. Although there was a bit of a chatter about the whole question of who gets the jobs in the new institutions.
Well, it's always important to stay on for a couple of days to provide the substance, Tony, but I remember being in Bratislava almost 3 years ago when this idea was announced to us all, and back then the idea seemed to be almost they were going to announce the relaunch of the European Union post-Brexit. It was going to be originally intended to be very close to the Brexit day itself. And then, of course, that got changed. And now it seems you're saying we're so close to the European elections, we can't actually announce anything of substance. And because Brexit hasn't happened yet, we can't really say anything about the future of the European Union. So really, there wasn't an awful lot to say at all. Or am I being harsh?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right in the... Well, the choreography was absolutely spot on. I mean, the initial plan from Jean-Claude Juncker, the Commission President, was to have this meeting on the 30th of March, the day after Brexit Day. That was scotched for obvious reasons. It's simply being a little bit too previous and too close to the actual date. So they picked Europe Day, May the 9th, as the more appropriate time to let a little bit of breathing space happen after Brexit Day. But of course, as you say, Britain hasn't left, so that did stymie things a little bit. But, you know, I think it was a good chance for the whole question of the jobs for in the new institutions to start. And there was the outline of already this confrontation between those who believe in what's called the Spitzenkandidaten process and those who want a more traditional approach to appointing the president of the European Commission, that being guided by the treaties where the heads of government meet at European Council level and go through the names and the dynamics of it and then pick a candidate. So we are actually in line for a fairly bruising confrontation. Some talk of a constitutional crisis for Europe over this whole process of appointing the next president of the Commission.
Indeed, and of course, traditionally, if there's no substance to be talked of, jobs often form the subject of discussions amongst leading politicians in the European Union. And as you say, the silent race for the jobs has been going on for well over a year now, but it has broken out into the public at Sibiu because we are so close and because the European elections do form, at least in theory, as you said, because of this Spitzenkandidaten process, they do form a part of the process of appointing to the top jobs, namely the President of the European Commission. But as you have been saying, the row has broken out into the public arena about whether the Spitzenkandidaten process should be carried on with. And we've had people from the ALDE party, like Xavier Bettel, effectively saying, the Prime Minister of Luxembourg, this process is unfair because it always favours the big two parties. And the way things have been going, it effectively favours the EPP.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point of the Spitzenkandidaten process in theory is that it gives more democracy to the process of appointing a very powerful position, the head of the Commission. The idea first came to life in 2014. You'll recall that Jean-Claude Juncker became the lead candidate or Spitzenkandidat for the European People's Party, the centre-right group. That happened at a convention in Dublin. And it was a very new and novel idea that drew quite a bit of heat because it did seem to break with treaty tradition and was seen as a bit of a power grab by the European Parliament. But on the other hand, they could argue that, you know, there's a constant refrain to make the European Union more democratic. What better way to do that than to give citizens the feeling, at least, that they were voting for ultimately somebody who might become the president of the European Commission. Now, already, as you say, we've had public rancor and division over this. Emmanuel Macron, the French president, very clear here yesterday in Sibiu on Thursday that he was opposed to the idea of a Spitzenkandidat. He said that simply restricted the field to a candidate from one political grouping in the European Parliament that got the most seats, and that the whole point was to get a competent leader of the European Commission. You had Sebastian Kurz, the Austrian Chancellor, saying, au contraire, it's very important for democracy that this is a process that is reflected in the treaties, that because of course European Union leaders have to take account of the results of the European elections, and of course it has to be, the nomination has to be approved by the European Parliament. So there is this tussle between the treaty tradition where heads of government make the decision and the parliament toes the line, and this new idea that the parliament and the groups themselves nominate the figureheads before the elections take place, and then that is respected by the heads of government.
Of course, it was easier 5 years ago in the sense that the EPP held so many of the prime ministerships around Europe, and so they were going to have the big say when it came to the European Council. But back in Helsinki a few months ago, it was Viktor Orban who pointed out to his fellow EPP leaders that they don't hold as many of the top jobs anymore, and that the people have exercised their own judgment against them at the ballot boxes, because, as he put it in his very pithy quote of that conference, we are the people who couldn't keep the Brits in and the immigrants out, and that's why they've lost power in Europe and don't really have the numbers to necessarily deliver their candidate, even if the EPP ends up as the biggest party in the European Parliament. And so by that process, they might end up defaulting back to the traditional method of appointing the Commission President, might they not?
Yeah, I mean, that's very true. And it's also reflected in the fact that the EPP is likely to lose quite a few seats in these elections. They could lose half their seats in Italy. They're under pressure in France with the rise of Marine Le Pen. And of course, Emmanuel Macron is trying to make a big impact there as well with his République En Marche group, which hasn't formally declared for the Liberal camp, but is expected to align with the Liberal or ALDE group in the European Parliment. But yeah, I think the overall tensions with Brexit and migration mean that this discussion over the top jobs is not a parlour game. It is actually very political and has the potential to be quite toxic, because there is always the prospect that if leaders immediately after the European Parliament elections decide on their own candidate, the European Parliament might simply turn around and say, well, we're not accepting that candidate, and you would be in a fairly uncharted territory at that point.
It sounds like they will need to go looking for a compromise candidate in that case. And given the name of our podcast, what about Mr. Brexit himself, Michel Barnier, who was, of course, the defeated candidate in that EPP Congress in Dublin 5 years ago, but has, by nature of his job, spent an awful lot of time going round the various capitals of Europe for the past couple of years, meeting all the prime ministers from all the different parties, liaising extremely closely with the European Parliament. So is he not the type of guy who might be acceptable?
Yeah, I mean, his name is mentioned a lot for those very reasons that you outline, although there was a bit of a view that he was so preoccupied with Brexit and the negotiations that he might not have time to do the proper lobbying and schmoozing that you might need to get the job. But his name is now mentioned frequently as a possible alternative to the EPP's formal candidate, which of course, as you mentioned, is Manfred Weber, who was appointed in Helsinki at that summit before the end of last year. Michel Barnier has been putting himself about a lot since the Brexit negotiations were concluded, and he is seen as a serious contender, even though he keeps saying he's not in the race, but we can take that with a normal pinch of salt. But he is French. He is admired across the EU for his handling of the Brexit negotiations. But I would think that there are other people who might start coming to the fore. And I think one candidate to look out for might be Christine Lagarde, of course, the head of the IMF and from the EPP family. But she is thought to be interested and would tick the whole gender box, because, of course, the Commission is seen as being vulnerable to charges of not having enough of a gender balance in its makeup. And, you know, this could be an interesting candidate to come forward that Emmanuel Macron might look at. And she would be a very well-known figure in Europe, but also globally. And, of course, there is a push at EU level to give Europe more heft internationally, more of a platform in the world to project its values, given that it seems to be getting squeezed on the one hand by the more protectionist instincts of Donald Trump on the one hand, and the more assertive reflexes of China and Russia on the other. So that's one candidate to look for. I mean, there's always the chance that you could have someone like Frans Timmermans, who's the socialist and Democrats candidate, managing to get some kind of consensus consensus in the European Parliament because the EPP is not going to do so well. And you could have this scenario as well where, because the UK is contesting these elections, you could have a good number of Labour Party MEPs coming in and filling those seats in the Socialists and Democrats family in the European Parliament. So that can't be ruled out either. But of course, all of this gets drawn into this vortex of trying to get the strategic balance right. So you have to balance between East and West, between right and left, North and South, male, female, and so on. And of course, there are a lot of other jobs coming up, like the president of the European Council. Donald Tusk, of course, is leaving the stage in the autumn. He has to be replaced. You've got the High Representative for Foreign Policy, Federica Mogherini, is leaving as well. So a lot of these jobs might sort of depend on each other as the kind of shuffling starts to really get underway.
Yeah, and the top slot of the European Central Bank as well in the autumn. Does Ireland have any strong views on any of this?
Well, Leo Varadkar, interestingly, was one of the first to come out of the traps to give his wholehearted support to the Spitzenkandidat process. And he was in Helsinki as well at that EPP Congress and was very vociferous in his support for Manfred Weber. And of course, Manfred Weber had been quite active in the Brexit debate during the negotiations. He was quite prominent at key moments. He was quite prominent in supporting the backstop and supporting Ireland's case in those negotiations. So that won him quite a few friends in Dublin. Although I would say that, you know, when you speak to officials, they will tell you privately that Manfred Weber is not seen as an entirely credible or competent candidate because he has never held a ministerial office. He's only been an MEP, although a very prominent MEP, and he's never been Prime Minister. And it would be quite unprecedented for a Commission President not to have held the post of Prime Minister.
Certainly not in recent years anyway. I guess we ought to be talking a bit about Brexit, given the sort of name of our podcast and trade description indeed. Laws and all that sort of thing. I'm going to bring in Fiona on this as well, but maybe briefly from you, Tony, was there any kind of Brexit talk? I mean, wherever one or two politicians are gathered in Europe, there normally is, but I know they didn't want to be talking about Brexit at Sibiu, but it surely must have leaked in somewhere.
Well, actually, all indications are that Brexit didn't really get a look in. I mean, they weren't here for that long, and you had a conversation about Europe's place in the world and talk about China. You had the backdrop of the tariff war, the trade war that's brewing again between China and the United States. You had the Iran situation coming to the boil again. You have a very tricky problem happening in the Mediterranean with Turkey drilling in the in Cypriot waters within Cypriot's exclusive economic zone. So that got quite a bit of attention yesterday as well at this summit. So yeah, not really any mention of Brexit that I could detect, although there was a side meeting here that was attended by Steve Barclay, the Brexit secretary, and he was making the point that look, you know, Britain wants to play a full part in Europe and the world, and we should just leave aside that awkward point about the result of the referendum, and let's just, you know, cooperate as best as we can. So that was really the only flicker of Brexit here in Sibiu.
Listen, by the sounds of that, the big long list of things you read out at the start, or I'm sure you didn't read it out, it came flowing naturally from the depths of your brain. It sounded like you were telling us subtly that there actually is more to life than Brexit. Surely not true. Let's go to London to find out what's going on the ground over there. Fiona, how are you doing?
Well, I'm not too bad, Sean, and in London there is not any more to life than Brexit, I have to say. And while Tony was talking about potential only flickers of Brexit in Sibiu this week, and the truth of it is there's probably only been flickers of Brexit around Westminster as well. While it is something that, of course, consumes the political air here, this has been a relatively quiet week, and that is not necessarily a good thing. You may remember Donald Tusk when that extension was granted to the UK on that March 29th deadline. You may remember him using the phrase, "Don't waste this time." Well, I think there's a lot of people around Westminster this week who could have probably been accused of a little bit of time wasting. It really has been relatively quiet. Some good news for MPs with the announcement that they're going to have a little bit more time off, that they're actually getting the quits on recess is going to take place from the 23rd of May for a week. But of course, that is yet another week lost. Now, we did have some of those cross-party talks continuing this week. There seemed to be some flicker of hope for them. And then at the weekend, that seemed to completely disappear. They are due to resume again next week. But really, the signs are not particularly good of what is coming out of them at the moment. There just doesn't seem to be enough movement. And obviously, this is a process that everybody thought would happen a little bit faster. I mean, those talks have been going on now for six, almost 7 weeks, I think it is. And really, there's just absolutely no movement on what was termed by both Labour and Conservative leaders when they started. This was termed as a national crisis. But as I say, the talks just continue with no real end in sight. That means that lots of speculation that Theresa May might try and return a vote or might even introduce the European Withdrawal Bill to the Commons next week, that has all been put to one side. There's certainly no chance of bringing back a vote on the Brexit agreement until there's some agreement with the Labour Party, if it can be found. So a lot of stasis really here in Westminster this week. But as I say, that is not a positive thing, because as all of that continues here, there's all of those rumblings, the leadership contest getting more and more headlines here on a regular basis. Quite frankly, you can't pick up a paper here now without seeing a Tory party MP and their spouse sitting in a kitchen drinking coffee very casually, but very dressed up and with very good makeup on. So all of the candidates now starting that kind of beauty parade, because really there's a lot of speculation that you could see Theresa May gone even by potentially the end of June.
Well, before we come to that, Fiona, I mean, that sounds just like what's going on in Sibiu with the European leaders. When there's nothing of substance on the agenda, you start talking about top jobs and who might fill those top jobs. But if I could just turn back to the timetable there, you're saying they've made one definite decision, and that is to book some holiday time, a week off on the 23rd of May. The following week is the visit for President Trump to the UK.
That's right.
Probably not a week to be bundling Brexit things through the House of Commons either. So that looks like a 2 week gap, does it not?
Essentially, yes. You're going to have President Trump here from the 3rd to the 5th of June. That, of course, on that first official state visit, and going to involve all the pomp and ceremony. He has been here before, of course, but not on that official state visit, just on a more regular run-of-the-mill visit. So you're going to have all the pomp and ceremony. You're also going to have sizable demonstrations. And, of course, don't forget that before all of that happens, you're going to have those European elections, because that was the other thing that happened this week. It was probably the worst kept secret imaginable, but there was a final confirmation from David Lidington that yes, the UK would have to take part in those European elections on the 23rd of May. So just as you think they should be digesting all of the fallout from those elections, and we expect that fallout to be pretty intensive, surprisingly, all of the MPs are going to be going on holidays. Elections on the 23rd, and also holidays starting on the 23rd. So you could say, if you were Theresa May, that perhaps the timing of that works quite well. But I think as MPs head off back to their constituencies, I don't think it's a case of they're not going to be hearing about this. And I think really the pinch points for Theresa May are going to come now more from what MPs are hearing in those constituencies, from grassroots workers, from people that they would have depended on to be going out during campaigns, knocking on doors, handing out leaflets. A lot of those people simply saying they are not taking part in this time out, and a lot of them very doubtful about where they would stand if it came to a general election. And obviously that is something which MPs are going to then be carrying back, and if there is a push against Theresa May, I don't think anybody is expecting her to be able to survive it this time. But before that, there's a hope that she will actually set out some kind of timeline herself. We know, of course, what she said is, well, there's an easy way to get rid of me. You just vote for my Brexit deal, and I've promised you I will go at that point. But they want something more than that. They want a timeline that doesn't involve them voting for her Brexit deal, because their fear is it simply will not get through. they're going to be stuck with her. So she's already met this week with Graham Brady of the 1922 Committee of Backbenchers. She's due to meet with the members of that committee again next week. But they're really looking for a timetable, because there is that horror of the idea that she might end up almost by default leading them into another general election, and really nobody can tell when that election might happen. So they really want some kind of clarity on that. But there's one thing we know about Theresa May is she has a particular skill for being able to not give clarity when clarity is the one thing that is needed. So there's a lot of concern over that, in the sense that it may very well be MPs having to move against her rather than her making the decision for herself.
You sound like you're describing a very particular Conservative Party version of cakeism, of people wanting to have one thing and another at the same time and not being able to get either of them. The Labour Party, of course, also has its own peculiar dilemmas to face in this election. And we saw the mauling that they got in the local elections last week. Tony mentioning there earlier that maybe there will be some more Labour Party members in the European Parliament that might influence selection of the next European Commission president, but then again, maybe not. There might be fewer Labour MPs returned, because there seems to be some suggestion as we draw to the end of this week that people may be drifting away from Labour and going to a range of pro-Remain, overtly pro-Remain parties in Britain. Is that a sense that you're picking up over there?
Well, there certainly is a feeling that Labour is again trying its own form of cakeism, really, Sean. Essentially, on Thursday, they launched their manifesto and their campaign for the European elections. And it really was a sense of, we can be all things to all people. Now, if Brexit has proven anything at this point, it's that really you can't be all things to all people. They kept within that manifesto the line about going for a second referendum on Brexit if and when essentially all other options have been exhausted and have been found not to work. And that is not something that a majority of Labour Party members right now wanted to hear. They wanted something definite from Jeremy Corbyn, who they feel is just sitting on the fence in relation to this. And so that has meant that, you know, you're going to be looking at a kind of a split vote. I mean, the European elections from the UK side will actually be very straightforward. It really is only about Brexit. And Labour, at the launch of its campaign this week, tried to say it's about other things. It's about inequality, it's about jobs, it's about, you know, a variety of things happening across the UK. But in truth, it really isn't. It's a very, very odd, bizarre kind of campaign. And really, it is all about Brexit, in a way that the last general election wasn't, in the way that perhaps even the local elections weren't, where you do bring in more local issues. This will be about Brexit. And so from that point of view, a lot of Labour Remain supporters were very unhappy about the fact that Jeremy Corbyn was just simply not getting off that fence and giving them what they want. And of course, there are now more splintered parties. If you want to say that you are a Remain supporter and that's how you want to vote, you have the option of the Lib Dems, you have the option of Change UK. But the fact that you're looking at those groups who are very splintered, who are, you know, all running candidates, and that's going to break up the Remain vote. That also means that you see somebody like Nigel Farage and the Brexit Party absolutely surging forward in the polls, and with the suggestion that he's going to pick up pro-Brexit votes from right across the Tories, potentially also from Labour, and a lot of anger amongst Remain supporters in the Labour Party, but also outside of that there's been a failure on the Remain side, as they see it, to manage to come together and say, we're going to have one banner for this, and we're not going to split the vote, and so we're going to send a message. Failure to do that has meant the Brexit Party is, as I say, absolutely surging forward and is on course to give particularly the Tories, but also Labour, an absolute drubbing in this vote.
Mm. And of course, the failure to unify and present a clear alternative to that, as you say, is a problem, because what you describe there is a proxy referendum on Brexit, and Nigel Farage's Brexit Party is very clear in what they're offering. But as you say, everybody else is not clear, particularly the two big parties. So people who vote for them there will be dispute naturally about whether their vote meant remain or leave, whether they were pro-Brexit or anti-Brexit. The way it looks to me is that you're going to end up with a three-way split, which is, of course, not what you want in any kind of a referendum situation, because you don't get the clarity that you so much desire and need in the political process that we have now.
Absolutely. You're facing into yet another situation where we will come out of this and you will have a complete lack of clarity. In fact, the only clarity, if you want to sort of draw it immediately from the numbers, if the polls are to be believed, then that the clarity will go towards something like the Brexit Party, which is already getting a huge wind in its sails from this campaign. And already this week, Nigel Farage saying he's now looking for candidates to run under the party banner in any upcoming general election. That is something that is really, really going to worry the Tories. Remember, all of this started, you could argue, by David Cameron and his fear of UKIP and what it might do to the Tory vote, saying, look, I'll give you a referendum on Europe, his belief being that people would vote to stay in and that he wouldn't then have to worry about UKIP. He could say, you've had your chance, it hasn't won, you now have to go away. In fact, what has happened is he has just seen Nigel Farage, yes, shed the UKIP cloak, but now come forward in terms of the Brexit Party and potentially, you could say, maybe learn quite a bit from the journey that he has taken through UKIP and learn quite a bit about what exactly attracts voters and how exactly he can manage to bring people on side. The Tories are going to be very worried about any resurgence of Nigel Farage, and that is quite clearly happening.
So the road to Brexit as rocky and as uncertain as ever. But even after Brexit happens, Tony, the pathways are not at all clear and not at all easy from what most experts have been saying. And you've been speaking to somebody recently who has been looking at the possible pathways that lie there, looking over the horizon, getting us beyond the immediate political hump of the Commons voting for some kind of a Brexit deal. What's that all about?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is this belief, especially exhibited by Theresa May herself, that, you know, she just desperately wants to get this thing over the line. You know, she keeps saying that people want Brexit to be sorted. That was the message that they inferred from the local elections. But the reality is that Brexit is not going to be sorted with the withdrawal agreement. And in some respects, even if the withdrawal agreement is approved, the next phase will be the trade negotiations. And they are not going to be easy by any means. Just before I introduce Larissa Bruner from the European Policy Centre, who's been looking at this issue, I should just pick up on Fiona's point there about the Brexit Party. And I think if, as expected, Nigel Farage's party does very well, then that is going to feed into the sentiment at EU level if we hit another deadlock in October with no agreement in Westminster about the withdrawal agreement and the request then for another extension. And I think the mood will be hardening in Europe against another extension if you have the rowdy lot coming in under the Brexit Party banner and Nigel Farage back in the European Parliament. People will be frankly fed up with that prospect, and they might harden their position on another extension of Article 50. But let's hear now what Larissa Bruner, who's an analyst with the European Policy Centre in Brussels, has to say about the pathways out of Brexit. Larissa, thanks very much for doing the podcast. You've written a piece for the EPC looking at the different scenarios confronting the main actors in Brexit at the moment, and none of them actually have a happy ending. I mean, what was your approach to this piece, first of all?
I mean, my main argument in the piece is that there's going to be more instability regardless of the outcome of Brexit, whether the UK leaves with a deal, whether the UK leaves with no deal, or whether the UK ends up deciding to remain in the EU. And my approach was really, I mean, I've been working on Brexit for quite a long time, and looking at the different scenarios one by one, I kind of started noticing that regardless, that I always kind of ended up at a rather negative outcome. And so for that piece, I decided to pull it all together and really show that Brexit has no happy ending.
So the some people conclude from the local elections that the message from the people was just get on with it. We need to just do a deal, fix this Brexit thing. We can move on to other policy issues. But your point is that there is no short-term end state for Brexit.
It's easy to agree that politicians should just get on with Brexit, but it's more difficult to agree on what this should actually look like. And I think a lot of people just want Brexit to be done, but don't really agree on how it should be done. And that's much more difficult because we've seen how difficult it is to get a compromise between Labour and the Conservatives. There are very different points of view, very different attitudes. So that's really difficult. And if you look at the different options, for example, a sort of Norway-style model, which would impose or which would inflict the least economic harm on the economy, that, of course, would be quite politically very difficult from because of a lot of other reasons. It would require the UK accepting freedom of movement of people, which is politically very difficult. It would require the UK to make contributions to the EU budget. It would basically leave the UK as a rule taker. So it would basically have to accept single market rules that the EU makes, but it wouldn't have a seat at the table. And I think for a country like the UK, that would be something that would be very difficult to accept. And I mean, what happens if the UK decided that it didn't want to adopt a certain piece of legislation? So you could see that in situations like that, is a lot of potential for conflict. And I also think that if the UK went for that model, there would be a lot of voices in the UK asking for change, asking for maybe an opt-out on freedom of movement, maybe opt-outs on other issues. So I think there would be a lot of dissatisfaction with this model.
The other end of the spectrum, of course, people have talked about a Canada Plus trade model. What would the drawbacks there be?
The main drawback would be that a Canada Plus model, so a comprehensive free trade agreement, would likely only cover goods and not so much services. But the UK is a service-based economy, and it's especially, for example, its financial services sector, mostly in London, is very important to the country. So if financial services, for example, and services more broadly are not covered, then that would still inflict a lot of damage on the economy. And I think it is very unlikely that the EU would go so far as to cover services as well. So it would still have negative economic consequences. At the same time, it would have to be based on the backstop, which means that the UK would essentially remain in a customs territory or customs union with the EU, which means that it wouldn't be able to set its own external tariffs. And having your own independent trade policy when you can't set your own tariffs is, of course, quite difficult. So it wouldn't really satisfy the hardcore Brexiteers, and it wouldn't satisfy the sort of pro-EU people.
So the overall point you're making is that even if a withdrawal agreement is approved by the House of Commons and we do get into the future relationship negotiations, by no means are these going to be easy, and by no means are they going to be pain-free. But before we get to that point, clearly we haven't got the withdrawal agreement over the line, and there seem to be many challenges to that. We're having talks this week between the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. What do you make of the chances that the Conservative Party could, or Theresa May could, agree to some kind of permanent customs union as the price that she has to pay to get this withdrawal agreement over the line?
I think the problem with a permanent customs union is that this idea that the UK could have its own independent free trade policy, that is really the last potential remaining economic benefit of Brexit. And I'm rather sceptical as to whether the UK would have a much more successful independent trade policy than it currently has with the EU. But it is still a potential economic benefit. And all other economic benefits of Brexit, or potential economic benefits of Brexit, have been discredited or they have been exposed as lies. If we think about the claim, the so-called Brexit dividend, the £350 million pounds per week that could be spent on the NHS, that is clearly a lie. GDP growth has slowed down, investment has slowed down. So we've seen all those things that have been touted as economic benefits slowly disintegrate. So this is really the last potential benefit. And I think that is why it's so difficult for Brexiteers to give that up. And that, I think, is really the problem with the customs union. I think getting a deal would be quite difficult because, not so much because Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn couldn't agree on something, but because I think it would be very difficult for them to sell it to the parties, because both would need to sell it as a victory and both would need to get convince even their backbenchers. And that, I think, is very difficult.
And I think that reveals this very bizarre situation where both leaders appear to be out of step with the mainstream view in their parties.
Yeah, I agree. I think on the Conservative side, of course, there are a lot of hardcore Brexiteers. On the Labour side, I think it's quite interesting that the party itself, where with a lot of pro-Remain, pro-EU MPs, has such a Eurosceptic leader who I think really doesn't want a second referendum.
I mean, just getting on to the future trade relationship and negotiations to that end, I think to me it has been very evident that a lot of people in the British government believe that simply getting the withdrawal agreement over the line is sufficient, and that the free trade agreement will be easy and that the backstop will not be needed. But of course, the backstop will have to be there if that future trade relationship is one of high alignment. Otherwise, you do need checks on the Irish border. Do you think that is properly understood in Westminster?
I'm not sure it is. And to be honest, when the principle of the backstop was agreed, I'm not sure whether the implications of that were properly understood. But I think we've seen that in a lot of different cases over the past almost 3 years, that things weren't properly understood. I think really agreeing the withdrawal agreement was supposed to be the easy part. So that's really worth keeping in mind. And I think agreeing the trade relationship is going to be much, much more difficult because of the reasons you just said, but also because I think differences among the EU 27 will come to the fore much more strongly. But that time, it's not going to be to the advantage of the UK, because what could happen is that basically every EU member state draws up a wish list, they go to the Commission, they give the Commission the wish list, and the Commission then has a very, very long list of demands and goes to the UK. And
not least fisheries, I guess.
Of course, yeah, fisheries is a very, very difficult topic, of course, and that then also plays into the whole Scottish debate. And if the Commission then goes to the UK with this very long list and very little room to compromise, that's going to be a very difficult position for the UK.
So that was Larissa Bruner there. Well, look, folks, what's going to be happening in the week ahead? Fiona, what are we looking at in Westminster on the Brexit beat?
Well, we'll have the resumption of those cross-party talks. Again, no real sense, as I say, that no expectation of a major breakthrough, but all eyes will be on what the mood music is coming out of those. Last week was described by Labour as a crunch week. That didn't seem to have much crunch to it in the end. So next week there will be a lot of expectation of where this goes from here. We'll also on Wednesday have that meeting of the 1922 committee. They will be wanting to hear from Theresa May a very definite timeline of when she plans to step down. If they don't get that, you can expect to hear many more mutterings. I don't think too much of a push against Theresa May until probably after the European elections are out of the way, because remember, at that stage, by next Wednesday, we've just days to go really to that. But certainly they will be all eyes on what exactly is said at that meeting and what kind of timeline she is giving her MPs.
And Tony, on the Brussels beach, what are we looking at?
Yeah, we're looking at the intensification of the European election campaign. We're going to have the main debate of the top four Spitzenkandidat, the lead candidates in Brussels in the European Parliament on the 15th. That's next Wednesday. So there you'll have the aforementioned Manfred Weber for the EPP, you'll have Frans Timmermans for the Socialists, and you'll have Guy Verhofstadt, who is the lead candidate for the Liberal Group, and Ska Keller, who's the candidate from the Greens. Then you're going to have a very interesting meeting in Milan next Saturday, where Matteo Salvini is of the far-right or anti-immigrant Lega party in Italy, who's expected to do very well in the European elections. He is trying to get an alliance of far-right, anti-immigrant and nationalist parties together in the European Parliament. So he's invited them all to a big meeting in Milan ahead of those elections. So that is really going to be one to look for.
Is Steve Bannon going to that one? He's been working with Salvini a bit recently, hasn't he?
Steve Bannon has been working away on his own pet European project. In fact, he's trying to open a kind of a European finishing school for the far right and anti-immigrant insurgents in Europe in a former Franciscan monastery in Lazio, which is a very curious project. So he wants to have a kind of an academy for the future far right and anti-immigrant movements in Europe. So that is a fairly intriguing prospect. But he has been, as you mentioned, he's been importing his particular vision of anti-left wing, anti-immigrant, anti-political correctness philosophy into Europe and into these European elections.
Well, no finishing school for me anyway, but finishing is something that we do have to do even in the finest of podcasts. So I must tell you, folks, that's all for this week in Brexit Republic. Colmo Mungon will be back next week after his trip to the Middle East. So from me, Sean Whelan in Dublin, thank you.
And from me, Fiona Mitchell in London.
And that's all from me, Tony Connolly in Sibiu. Thanks for listening.